This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
We'll talk about, can irony and humor be persuasive for Christian belief? And if everything works, I will have an outline for you. Hope most of you can see that. So can irony and humor be persuasive for Christian belief? This is really about dealing with Christian apologetics. The idea of there's two sides to apologetics. There's one is defending the faith with those who attack it or discredit it. And the other is to persuade people to actually trust in Christ. So it's got a negative and positive side. Christians have sometimes, I think quite often, been disdainful of humor and fearful of irony. And I'm trying to redress both of those and say that maybe one day we might do a better Christian apologetic by grappling with how both irony and humor are integral into the fabric of the Bible itself and into Christian communication at its best. So to start in on the task, briefly on the task of apologetics, I'm not going to lay it out in any abstract way. I just wanted to start with a statement from the Apostle Paul, where he doesn't use the word apologetics or apologia, but he's describing his task in a passage in 2 Corinthians 10, which is a fascinating thing because he's really talking about the spiritual battle. And this is the shape that battle takes. For the weapons of our warfare are not merely human, but they have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle raised up against the knowledge of God. And we take every thought captive to obey Christ. Now, he starts here with a clearly negative metaphor, knocking down strongholds, fortresses, protective walls. The idea is here, knocking down strongholds which guard someone who is not a Christian, so they don't need to hear or be confronted by God, the revelation of God in the world, knowledge of God that's available. So people who are surround themselves, and our culture is very helpful in this. Many cultures are will give people a surrounding wall so that the knowledge of God doesn't break through in any persuasive way. And so he's talking about we need to destroy these strongholds. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle raised up against the knowledge of God. Notice that it's the power of God that he's using to try and break this down. He knows the power of God is available to him to do this. It's not that he's got to just do more academic degrees and learn more facts. He's got to do a lot of study, which he certainly did, but he's ultimately appealing and depending on the power of God to help him to do this. To disillusion people with whatever it is that makes an obstacle between them and knowing God. Notice that it's not only destroying arguments, but every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God. That means what can stand against someone knowing God or even learning about God is not just arguments against God that are written up by Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or something like this, but it can be anything. It can be anything. It can be other people. It can be possessions that stand against you taking God seriously, or desire for possessions. It can be heroes. I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. It can be lifestyle lifestyles. It can be dreams, powers, pleasures, as well as arguments. Of course, it can be arguments, but it can be anything that can stand against you taking God seriously. And so Paul is committed to, I've got to knock down these strongholds that get in the way of the revelation of God that's really coming at us. And this, of course, for anyone trying to do this, is a tremendous demand on the Christian's imagination, trying to do the very thing that Paul says he's trying to do here, but doing with the power of God and by the power of God, with a sense of dependence on God. How do you find out? How do you know what the obstacles are in someone's mind and how they work in their life and how they could be questioned? Is a huge task to unpack. It also means prayer to God for this divine power as to how to go about to destroy strongholds. It doesn't mean to destroy people. That's not what he's saying here. Destroy strongholds which keep people that you love from knowing the God that you love. That's what he's talking about here. The strongholds that keep people that you love from the God that you love. Both Paul and perhaps even more Jesus did this fortress breaking repeatedly. Then there's the positive side, this which is taking every thought captive to obey Christ. This is to commend Christ, to not just knock down obstacles that they have in the way of knowing about Christ and God, but to actually commend Christ to them. Positive persuasion, showing Christ to be the truth that they want to embrace. That means always something much more than just strictly cognitive rational argument. It includes that more and less, depending on where anybody's coming from. But it must also mean having someone see Jesus as someone they actually want to follow as their Lord. That's something much more than just a cognitive process of these facts, I believe. This is a very different, or not, it's linked totally to the factual truth of Jesus, but it's much more in the sense of it has to do with your desires and your wants and what you want to do with your life in your own future. Calvin started his Institutes of the Christian Religion with a couple of sentences which I am forever quoting, or not, I'm just referencing them tonight, but they're so rich and so deep that I never get to the end of them. But he says basically that there's two important kinds of wisdom that overwhelm all the rest: knowledge of God and knowledge of ourselves. And then he says a fascinating thing. He says, I can't for the life of me figure out which one comes first, which one precedes, which one gives birth to the other. And he basically argues they don't. There isn't one that precedes. There's a feedback loop between them. Your idea of God affects your idea of yourself. Your idea of yourself affects your view of God. You have messed up ideas of God, it's going to mess up your view of yourself. You have messed up views of yourself, it's going to mess up your idea of God. And so there's an interdependence there. And I would say that's totally true when it comes when we enter into the discussion of apologetics. You have these two areas which are overwhelmingly important. Who is God and who are you? Who is God and who are you? To become a Christian at all, you need to know certain things that are true about God. He's a creator. He's a person. He's holy. And of course, there's enormous, just in saying those three words, enormous amount of things that the apologist must deal with in a society where there's such an enormous plurality of ideas about God. I remember Francis Schaeffer saying years ago, back in the 1970s, there's no more meaningless word in the English language than the word God. By which he meant, it can mean anything. It can mean anything. And so, when someone uses the word God, don't think that you, because you believe in God, necessarily agree with them about much of anything till you've talked, till you've heard what they really believe about who God is. So, enormous amount to do in terms of discussing who God is. But then, because of the time constraints of this talk, I want to spend most of the time on self-understanding. How we understand a person, a human being, how somebody understands themselves, and how this functions in the apologetics of the Bible itself. And I'll be dealing mostly on what's actually in the Bible. Who are you? Who do you trust in? Who do you hope in? What are the obstacles that you are dealing with to knowing or trusting God? And to know who you are, the Bible starts you out with two primal events that that put you really on the right track. You first of all, we're gloriously created by God in God's image and God's likeness, able to reflect his character and have communion with him. Then, almost immediately, there's the fall, where our first parents rebelled against their creator and benefactor, wanting independence and godlike status for themselves, and instead brought ruin and death down on their own heads, with sin warping their ability to communicate with God, with each other, and with themselves. So a very broad impact on human experience is a result of this, of the first sin. As we've probably said hundreds of times from people standing here, Francis Schaeffer used a term about a human being: every human being is a glorious ruin. And that goes right back to these two primal events that I've described. The creation in glory, in the image of God, but the ruin coming on us as a result of the fall. And so we're a glorious ruin because we're both glory and ruin are bound up in our very post-fall identity. Pascal put this with typical force. He says it is dangerous to make a man see too clearly his equality with the brutes without showing him his greatness. It's also dangerous to make him see his greatness too clearly without showing him his vileness. But it's very advantageous to show him both. Now, what he's saying here is it's really important to know these things about yourself, not just as a matter of curiosity, but if we don't, we're dangerous. If we don't, we're dangerous. A lot of what I will be saying tonight will be trying to not disappoint Pascal on this point that I've just read. Okay? Because I'll be dwelling very much on this. This two-sidedness will be coming up throughout the rest of the talk. So I hope I'm gunning for his approval. So what I've said thus far is that contradiction, paradox, and irony are bound up in the human identity. If we understand ourselves truly and biblically, the Christian must have some grip on both sides of this irony. Both the glory and the ruin, if we're to understand ourselves. If our self-knowledge sees only glory and no ruin, we will be arrogant, self-important, self-righteous, have naive utopian hopes, and no sense of the need of God's grace. Okay? That's if you see yourself as glory, but without the ruin. This arrogance is a wall or a stronghold protecting that person from knowledge of God. It's a proud obstacle to the knowledge of God that's around anybody that is defining themselves, thinking of themselves in that way, protecting them from the revelation of God, the knowledge of God. If, on the other hand, our self-knowledge sees only ruin and no glory, we're in despair, apathy, cynicism, nihilism, thinking that we're just dirt, we have no meaning, no dignity, useless accidents in the world. This despair or disengagement with the world is also a major obstacle to the knowledge of God. It's also a wall protecting people from knowing God truly, because they'll just say, it's just trash. It's all a mistake. It's all a terrible accident. There's no meaning to it. And any word from God is just a false and naive hope. Now, the biblical prophets and apostles and Jesus himself spent a great deal of time helping people to destroy these obstacles and protective walls which came from twisted self-understanding, that they might then glimpse and embrace true self-knowledge and true God knowledge. To understand ourselves as both glory and ruin, we need God at the center, and we will, if we do understand those, also want the gospel, be hungry for the gospel if we're not already a Christian. Because we'll know that we have value, we'll know also that we're in deep trouble and we need mercy. And so we need mercy, and it doesn't mean we're just junk and useless and pathetic, because we're of value, So we know both of our value and our need for mercy. And so we will be open to the gospel if we're not already a Christian. I can remember before I was a Christian myself, in the year and a half or so I was, or 2 years, I was trying to figure out what was true and whether I wanted to believe in the Christian faith or not, or whether it was true. One of the things that drew me to it was basically two things. One, that in the Christian faith that I'd seen and in the Bible that I'd read, I saw the highest moral ideals of excellence and glory that I'd seen anywhere and that I was aware of in human literary production or religious tradition. But at the same time, this book, and during that year, I read the Bible straight through in a very short period of time. And what struck me is that how deeply flawed all these people were. The Bible is filled with sketchy characters. And it's just filled with them. There's no attempt to put on rose-colored glasses, no attempt to say, oh, you just believe in Jesus, everything works out beautifully for you. No, this rough and tumble and people falling flat. And I think of Peter's denial, Peter promising that all these bums, these disciples may deny you, but I would never deny you. And then within 24 hours, he denied Jesus 3 times. And he is the great leader of the church in Jerusalem, for crying out loud. He's the one we're meant to look up to and respect and all this stuff. But the Bible's absolutely brutally honest about him. And I thought, wow, this is something. These two things together. The highest moral standard you can conceive of in the teaching of Jesus in particular. And then look at these sketchy dudes who were stumbling along and yet somehow used by God, somehow doing a lot of amazing things at the same time. So this was, to me, one of the things that persuaded me of the truth of the Bible itself. Now, moving on to gave you the outline again. The irony and biblical apologetics. I want to get at the idea of irony itself. I'm using the word not sort of in a technical literary way. There are various technical ways it's used as a literary form, but much more broadly, perhaps crudely. I'm using the word as the coming together of two things which are discordant, paradoxical, and jar against each other, but nonetheless are tied together in a way that are hard to pry apart. That you don't expect them to be together. They don't belong together. They sort of fight against each other, and yet they're tied together. There's two kinds of irony that I want to talk about. One is what I've just described to you one is what I've just been talking about, the way we're called to believe in ourselves. That we are, there's an irony in terms of being a glorious ruin ourselves. In this way, it leads right to the gospel of Christ. It's the irony of Pascal's greatness and vileness, all used to describe the same person. It's the irony of Schaeffer's glorious ruin, used to describe the same person. This is the irony of human nature after the fall. Biblical writers try and persuade people to grasp this and to accept this and to believe it. And if they do, they will reach out to God for the gospel when you do. You'll know that you need mercy and that the God of mercy is there for you. That's one kind of irony. That's the one I've just described, basically. There's another use of irony, the second way, which is when irony is presented to us, which is intolerable and unbearable. Ironies that we should reject, not try to live with. When we face them, we're meant to realize that we've made a serious mistake and we need to back up, have a reality check, and change direction in life and start looking to God in a new way. These ironies come on us usually from trying to make belief in God work. To make unbelief in God work in God's world, to be an image of God, live in God's world, and yet to function without believing in Him. That's when you get these what I'm calling intolerable, unbearable ironies, which we're not meant to just live with and say, oh well, The world is hard, but we're meant to say, stop and back up and say, where have I gone wrong? Where can I turn? I'll think, look here at just a, you could tackle all kinds of things here, but the passage of time. What happens to us in the passage of time? What happens to our self-understanding across time? This is an often repeated biblical theme of transience and the impact of transience. I'll look at a familiar piece of Psalm 103. I'll just start with the beginning of it. As for mortals, their days are like grass. They flourish like a flower of the field, for the wind passes over in it and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. This is a simile. What are we like? We are like grass and flowers that flourish in a field. This is referencing human beauty, creativity, success, importance, recognition, dignity, praise coming for a variety of things that we're gifted to do. We thrive, we work, we grow, we build, we flourish. This is what we're created to do. This is what being made in the image of God, fearfully and wonderfully made, we're capable of doing. This is our glory, made in God's likeness. But what happens over time is that this picture does not last. It doesn't last at all. We're like the grass and the flowers that flourish, but the wind passes over it and it's gone, and its place knows it no more. Just a very brief statement of a huge truth of transience and how our youth doesn't last. Our lives don't last. What happens over time? Time brings ruin to us. The wind passes over it, and the flower fades, withers, and dies, and disappears, and leaves no trace. Like flowers, not just that are the flowers of this summer earlier on, but the flowers, where are the flowers of three summers ago? You won't find any trace of them, recognizable trace of the flowers of three summers ago. And 3 years isn't very long. This is the ruin of death and decay from sin's entry into the world. The tragic, shattering irony that time turns our glory into loss. Our glory and importance from dignity and significance to undifferentiated dust. The complete loss of the unique, distinct person with the identity that he or she once had becomes dust. Think of how many people have resonated with Shakespeare's line in Macbeth, the idea of judgment on life made in the presence of death, that life itself is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. To someone just being smacked in the face with death and its power and saying, well, the whole of life is just absolutely empty and a fake. But the Bible doesn't stop there. The next verse is, but the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him. This is completely shifts the gears from what you, from flowers rotting and being any trace of them being left. This changes the whole picture. Time chews up human glory and spits it out and leaves nothing but dust and ashes, unless God is at the center of that life. What time does to human glory is an outrageous irony. An outrageous irony which is totally the result of sin, the wages of sin, which smashes us in the face. And we should not accept it. We say, oh, well, yes, that's, no, which it should shock us. It should be a blow to us. One of Flannery O'Connor's many grievances about the modern world is that we have domesticated despair. There is despair, and there's things that we should despair about, but we've domesticated the despair. We've made it comfortable. We've made it a sort of able to be household normal. We've taken unbearable ironies like this, like the reality of death and destruction, and domesticated them, treated them as if they're something normal to live with and get comfortable with. Our transience is meant to stop us cold, being considered like a flower of the field, like grass or flower of the field. It ought to stop us cold and push us to back to rethink if God isn't the center of the stage for us, if God is not the center of the stage for us. But his steadfast love keeps the glory of his people as glory from everlasting to everlasting. In other words, with him, glory lasts. The glory of who we are as the image of God doesn't just last, but expands in the resurrection that is our hope. The protective obstacles, the walls keeping us from knowing God, are illusions and mirages about youth and power going on forever, which they don't. Illusions about death being something that happens to other people, which it doesn't. I remember said one of Freud's favorite jokes was a man says to his wife, if one of us should die before the other, I would go to live in Paris. Now, the fact that that was one of his favorite jokes to me is a bit much, but it may tell you more about Freud than anything. But he's hammering something that is very, very real. Death doesn't happen to me. It won't happen to me. That's other people. But you see, this is what I mean by protective walls around ourselves, protecting ourselves from the revelation of God that's coming at us, and that we're meant to stop. And there are things that occur to us, that happen to us, that are meant to make us stop and say, this is an irony that is too much to swallow, it's too much to handle. I need to back up and ask a lot of questions and ask where my life is going. For me, a favorite topic from years and years has been heroism, because I've just felt that heroes are much more important than most people realize, mainly because they live in our imagination, and I think our imaginations have much more to do with the way we live our lives than we give our imaginations credit for. And so we think of, I have these values and I have these priorities and so on. But we have also locked in our somewhere all sorts of heroic ideas of what human glory is, human excellence is. Heroes are people that we hold in our imaginations, which represent what we would like to become ourselves. I think it was Augustine may have said, one of the most important things you can ask someone is, what do you want to become? What would you like to become? You learn most about someone by asking them that question, if they answer it honestly. An excellent question. They focus on your aspirations, and they have enormous power to shape your life, my life, all of our lives, in any direction. Because anything can be considered heroic to any one of us. We can follow, make a hero out of almost anybody, for or against God. But someone can be heroic to you and me for all the wrong reasons, and so be a fortress wall and obstacle to the knowledge of God, blocking us. Our heroes can block us from the knowledge of God. Their heroic values lead us away from God. Maybe their heroism coming out of Hollywood, Madison Avenue, Wall Street, or anywhere. There's no evil location for heroes. They can occur anywhere, and good and bad. But a false hero is a serious problem. That means someone who functions heroically for you, but for all the wrong reasons. That's what I'm calling a false hero, a pseudo-hero. He or she can have enormous power over your imagination to dismiss God and Christ and the Christian way of life for being unheroic and therefore not just rejected but despised. How does the Bible help free us from these obstacles? It's not by lectures and arguments. It's by retelling stories. And what I would call the ironic exposure of fool worship. I'll explain what that means. The Bible confronts our imagination directly by reframing, again, not lecturing us, don't do this, that's naughty, don't stop doing that, that's bad, but just tells us stories that reframe what heroism is in our imagination, reframing the false hero to show the false hero, the hero that's heroic to you for all the wrong reasons, is actually a fool. A fool is not usually stupid, but it's always someone who's arrogant before God and other people. The false hero always ends up, in truth, not being really a hero, but being a fool, which means being a loser and a jerk. So it does not not capture aspiration, but rather aversion, the opposite of of aspiration. The Bible never allows, it's interesting, of all the, you can think of the modern literature that makes evil attractive, exciting, interesting, fascinating. The Bible never allows evil to be attractive, glamorous, or honorable in its images, narratives, metaphors, or whatever. The fool in the Bible is there to inspire aversion, that we would be free from false heroism, to connect rightly with God, with our whole imagination, not just in some formal way, but as whole people, and follow real heroes. There's a fascinating Proverbs 26:8 proverb says, which is it's in a sense it's an abstract one in that it speaks very widely, not just dealing with specific things. It is like binding a stone in a sling to give honor to a fool. It's like binding a stone in a sling to give honor to a fool. Now, I don't know any of you played with slings growing up. I did quite a lot. Something about you can make a sling out of your belt if it's a flexible belt. You can grab both ends of the belt here and put a stone down here and spin it carefully, faster, slowly, faster and faster, so that the stone stays in the sling faster and faster and faster. And then you're really going well, and you let one end go, and the stone goes zinging out way faster and farther than you could ever throw it, as you let one end of the thing go. And this is what I guess David did to Goliath and various other people. There's a great tradition of slinging things at people. But you think what he's saying here? He who binds a stone in a sling. What does that mean? It means you bind a stone in the sling so it can't be released. You swing it around like that. When you finally release your end of it to let it go, what happens? It comes whamming back and hits you in the face. Or at least goes nowhere and spins around. But this is what, you see, this is an invitation, this little proverb is an invitation for you to write a skit. To let Charlie Chaplin do it or some other capable person to act it out. But see, this is what this is what giving heroic status to the fool is. You really hurt yourself. The image is of a fearless hunter going out. This is where you need Charlie Chaplin to be the fearless hunter, and to go out and then the whole thing blows up. But this is you give heroic status or honor or glory to the fool, to the pseudo-hero, and this is what it's about. It just blows up in your face. The modern equivalent would be to put a weld in a rifle barrel, and the whole thing will blow up in your hands and in your face if you put a weld in a rifle barrel or a shotgun barrel. So there's a rich development of the fool and his cousins in wisdom literature, cousins being sluggards and scoffers and so on, all help people to get rid of their false heroes, to realize that the people they may look at as heroic really, when the push comes to shove, expose themselves as being losers and jerks, obstacles to the knowledge of God. I think of the idol of sexual freedom today, a massive obstacle to the knowledge of God, obstacle to the Christian faith. I think of the role of male sexual conquest, the heroic stud is addressed in Proverbs, but in a way that, as you might expect, is going to hit you with irony. Says the heroic stud is like an ox that goes to the slaughter. Wait a minute. That's not what I was thinking of. No, like an ox that goes to the slaughter. It's easier to see maybe the accuracy of this proverb now after the Me Too movement. We see many entitled male leaders of the media lining up, going as oxen to the slaughter, losing their careers, their money, and everything else under the sun as a result of this. It's an irony not to walk into, but to reject, to back up, and make sure this is not you, because this is what's actually involved here in the sight of God. Or for women, unhappily, like a gold ring in the snout of a pig is a beautiful woman without sense. What are you meant to do with that? You know, these are not arguments. They are powerful, jarring, ironic visual images. But you're meant to do something with them. You're not meant to just go on to the next verse or go on to the New Testament reading. They're aimed at dethroning values, valued images, valued people, valued heroic practices, hero systems, dethroning heroes who are obstacles to the knowledge of God. You're invited to construct them as visual images and pictures and let their irony work on you. Let them work. They're meant to work. They're meant to do their job just by letting them turn around, meditate on them. It's an irony which smashes the authority and attractiveness of false heroism. An irony that makes you not want to live with it. I want to leave that and go in a different direction. You think of, there are a lot of very obvious things in the Bible. Nathan confronts David in this classic time in 2 Samuel, I guess 13 or something. Tells David a parable about a man's sheep stealing and general immoral life and uncaring life. David's enraged at the man. Then Nathan said, "You are the man I've just described. You. This is a story of you." And David was met here with an intolerable irony, an unbearable irony that he could not live with. He could not hold together his self-image of a righteous king, of an entitled king, to do all sorts of, you know, exceptional things that other people aren't allowed to do, and what he'd just heard of this absurd hypocrisy and cruelty and viciousness and thoughtlessness, etc., that he's just heard about himself. His self-perception, his self-understanding just went completely in the trash the minute he heard this, and he couldn't gainsay it. He couldn't disagree with it. It nailed him, and he saw Nathan was absolutely right. And so he did what he had to do, which is to turn and to repent and say, "I've sinned against the Lord." He repented and turned to the gospel. But that's what I mean by an irony that's an unbearable irony, that he just couldn't live with it, and so he had to, and very properly, to turn, admit it and turn to God. The irony is always that the fool whose public image is heroic and so on is shown to be pathetic in reality. You can think of Jesus' parable of the rich fool in Luke 12. He's the hero of investment capital, made lots of money, plans to retire, relax, and party. But God says to him, and Jesus says this in the parable, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." Now, Jesus doesn't give a moral lecture, doesn't tell you what he should have done with his money instead. He just says, "You fool. On your own reckoning, you're a complete loser and a jerk. On all your own values. You've got complete life completely wrong, with no room for God, and you lose everything even that you wanted and valued most." The irony is that this is an irony that no one should want to tolerate or tolerate. This is an exposure of fool worship. What strikes me is here is oftentimes this great hero of the corporate world is known as someone who's really knows how to control things, to make things happen and so on. And look what he's done. He doesn't even have time for one party. Not one party. Tonight, your life is over. And so it's a total exposure. Think of the prodigal son parable in this light. When the younger son came to himself, it was the realization of the unbearable irony that his father's hired servants have plenty to eat and to spare. That means they might have been throwing food away at home. But here I am dying of hunger, envying these pigs for what they're eating. Something wrong with this picture. I can't deal with the irony of these two parts of what's in my mind. And so he did basically what David did. He said, "I'm going home and I'm going to say sorry. And I'm going to offer to sign in as a hired laborer at home." And he's become the sort of classic illustration of the gospel of Jesus Christ just in doing this as a lived out parable. I want to look at a little bit different example from Jesus' life and his ministry. Sorry, give the outline again. You'll notice as you read the Gospels that early on, Jesus starts to get busted in the synagogue. And you wonder, does he not hear? Does he not know the rules? What's going on? It happens again and again. All three Gospels starting right off at the beginning. All four Gospels. What's happening? Usually he was the visiting preacher, and he still gets thrown out, rebuked by the synagogue leader. I've been going to church for 50 years at least. I've never seen a pastor throw out a visiting preacher and rebuke a visiting preacher to his face after the sermon or something like this. This is what happened. This is what happened here. You got to realize what was going on. He was walking into a highly legalistic religious system for which one of the most important absolutes was observing the Sabbath correctly. You could do no work on the Sabbath, but if that's a tight rule, you've got to know, well, what is work and what is not work, okay? There were, to help out, there were 39 activities that were called work that the scribes had figured out. They were designated work with many, many qualifications, exemptions, clarifications, and loopholes surrounding those 39 categories of work. This was the work of the scribes, probably the closest to our modern tax lawyers as anything. Healing was in the list considered work and therefore not allowed on the Sabbath. You could bandage a wound. This gives you a sense of what Jesus was up against, which is not immediately obvious in the pages of the New Testament. You could bandage a wound to stop the bleeding. That was not work, because that was just to stop it from getting worse. You could not put ointment on the same bandage and then put it on the wound, because that was to actually make it get better, and that was healing. So that was work and prohibited on the Sabbath. See what I'm saying? That was the level of what Jesus was dealing with. And so it gives you an idea of maybe why he chose healing as the place to jump in and really enter his challenge. Because he's bringing a new religion to his own nation, a new approach to religion from what they've, not from their tradition, but from what they're practicing at that time. So healing was, healing was considered work. And so what did he do on the Sabbath? He healed people. Some who'd come to him to ask for healing, others who didn't even come to him to ask for healing, he healed them right there in the service for all to see. Now, you got to realize, he could have taken any of them out behind the synagogue, behind a bush, and healed them after the service. He could have waited till sunset, when the Sabbath was technically over, and healed them then. In any other case, he would have avoided conflict, the kind of conflict that he got. But he didn't. He obviously got busted on purpose. Luke 13, verse 10, following Jesus' teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath, and he noticed a woman who was crippled. He called her over. It was his initiative, not hers, and healed her. Whereupon the synagogue ruler was indignant, freaked out, told the people, if you ever want to heal, be healed, come back on a different day, and gave Jesus an earache. Then Jesus turned to him and rebuked the leaders of the synagogue. He says, you hypocrites, does not each one of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away and give it to water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day? And Luke records that the crowd loved it. The crowd was totally behind Jesus, was rejoicing. Not including the leaders. But I want you to see what he was doing. Something very, very important was he was doing here. He was driving a wedge between their humanness, by which I mean their empathy, their joy for this woman who is their friend and neighbor, who'd just been healed after 18 years of suffering, their humanness, but you drive a wedge between their humanness and the legalistic religious system that they've been living under, that required them to believe that this event that they just witnessed, this healing that they'd just seen, was a terrible sin and a serious defiance of God. Now, he's driving a wedge, forcing them to go one way or the other. Synagogue rulers are saying, what you've seen is a terrible sin and should never have been done. They say, good grief, look at what's happened. She's free. She's able to stand up. She's able to walk around, all this stuff. What Jesus is doing is trying to expose their religious tradition, their legalistic tradition, and its hollowness, its anti-humanist, and he's to pry them loose from that to decrease their loyalty to that. He's getting their consciences to push back against their own laws and customs. Who could not rejoice at her healing? But how petty and warped any legal system is that would prohibit such a healing. If you had been there, how would you have reacted? Do you suppose, if you've been there to watch all this? And so it was tremendous. And he obviously won the day. The people were with him and were cheering him on. But you see, what he's doing is he's planting a seed there of saying there's something new happening. There's something very, very different happening. And this was the same legal system, you see. Let me say just a quick footnote here. Is that any of you who thought or studied Francis Schaeffer's apologetics very much, realize he too drove a wedge very often between someone's sense of their own humanness and their worldview, which wouldn't allow them to be as human as they wanted to be. In other words, their worldview, which was materialistic or naturalistic or whatever, which would have no room for high moral values and so on, he would drive a wedge between them, between their humanness, between their human responses to the world and their own worldview, their own view of things that wouldn't really allow them to take their own humanness as seriously as that. Not to go into that, but you need to realize that's a pattern that Jesus is using here that is still very operative in the world today, not with a kind of legalism of the first century Jewish community, but with all sorts of other things. But with this legalistic system, if they kept all the rules, that rule keeping gave them the illusion that they were righteous before God, and that this righteousness before God, because they're rule keeping, meant that they wouldn't need God's grace. They wouldn't need someone else to atone for their sins. They wouldn't need a savior. They wouldn't need a Messiah who would ever suffer for them. There was no radical need for the grace of God if they made themselves acceptable to God by their keeping of these rules. And we know that they did. I mean, the Apostle Paul said, looking back on his experience as a Pharisee, I was, as to the law, blameless. Looking back, he says in Philippians, I did it all, even all the Sabbath regulations. I did it all. And so was able to just have great confidence that since I've kept the law, I'm accepted. And so, what is an example of how depending on what our view is of ourselves, that affects our view of God. If your view of yourself is that you're good enough to obey God and satisfy God by your obedience, that means your view of God is a God who is going to be impressed by exactly that kind of obedience and that sort of legalism, which may have nothing to do with where your heart is, but have everything to do with the rules you keep and the brownie points you accumulate. So what he was doing was something very, very profound in terms of challenging a legal system that would make people aware that they didn't need what he'd come to do. Okay, what I've done here so far is to look at the irony of just being a glorious ruin that we all need to embrace in some ways. And that's all, another kind of irony, which is an irony that we should not embrace, an irony that if we experience it, we need to back off and say, where have I gone wrong? I'm going to shift now and talk about humor, potential of humor, persuasive potential of humor. What in the world is humor? That's a huge topic, which I won't get into very much. Many have tried to define humor. Usually it's a failure. Define some universal principle of what makes things funny and not. E.B. White concluded, essentially it's a complete mystery. Humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the scientific mind. So, you can say all sorts of things and have all sorts of fun laughing without knowing what is actually the essence of all humor. We can say some things about humor. I've been attracted to a statement by Schopenhauer, picked up by Chesterton and others. Schopenhauer, of all people I would not think of as humorous, said it's a sudden perception of incongruity. Okay? Chesterton actually picks up very similar. It's incongruity perceived. Things are suddenly recognized as out of focus, but are strangely connected in an unexpected and wonderful way that somehow tickle your funny bone. This is as good a baseline as any, I'm afraid. My suspicion is that all humor is somehow incongruity perceived. But, let me quickly say, not all incongruity is funny. Tragedy is incongruity. So what makes some incongruity funny remains a mystery. Like, for example, flying jetliners into skyscrapers is certainly incongruous, but not many of us thought that was funny, although I guess some people did in a different part of the world. What specifically is funny to different people reflects all the differences that there are between people. Age, sex, race, class, ethnicity, geography, occupation, historical period, of the particular things that trigger making people laugh are enormously different. But I think common to them is some idea of incongruity perceived. If you take Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons, he starts with incongruity in that he claims the freedom to create a world giving animals human language and human technology and basically middle-class accoutrements. Phones, cars, chemistry labs, suburban houses, full range of kitchen appliances, and so forth. And from this, he can create, most of the time, an almost infinite number of things that, to me, are funny. We can also argue about whether something was funny or not. I'll restrict myself to just mention one, which is particularly outrageous. A single frame, a cartoon of two amoebas sitting in their home watching a movie screen. And the caption is porno films. And it's lewd pictures of cell division. So here he's, anyway, I won't try to explain that. less erotic than looking through a microscope at cell division? That's right. I've used this example before, and some of you may have heard it before in lectures, but there's a fascinating example in a course book from Middlebury College I got when our middle son was there, because it illustrates the role of incongruity in humor. Okay, it takes me a minute to read it, but some years ago, a National Educational Journal recounted the story of a professor called in to mediate a dispute about a grade. A student in a certain physics course had been asked to explain how one could determine the height of a tall building by means of a barometer. Okay, that's the assignment. The answer given was an F, and the student objected that, on the contrary, the answer was perfectly correct, according to accepted physical principles. When the outside mediator was called in, he had to agree that the student had a point. The answer given was, go to the top of the building, tie a string on the end of the barometer, lower the barometer to the ground, and measure the length of the string. Nevertheless, it was agreed that the student should be given a second opportunity to answer the question more straightforwardly. After 6 minutes of the allotted 10 had been used, the student had still not written anything on his paper, and the mediator asked whether he did not know the answer. No, he replied, it's just that there's so many answers, I'm trying to decide which one to give. Near the end of the time period, he quickly scribbled down an answer. This time the instructor in the course capitulated, and the student was given an A. The answer given was, take the barometer to the top of the building and drop it off. Time the fall, and then by the well-known formula about the rate of acceleration of falling bodies, calculate the height. The mediator was fascinated with this ingenuity of the student and asked whether he really had other answers. Of course, he replied. Take the barometer out on a sunny day. Measure the shadow cast by the barometer and the shadow cast by the building. Then knowing the height of the barometer, you calculate the height of the building. Or, a very simple and direct method would be to start at the base of the building and measure the building by laying the barometer along the walls to determine the height and barometer lengths. Finally, of course, the easiest method would be to go into the basement and find the office of the superintendent, knock on his door. When he answers, say to him, here, I have this fine barometer that I'll give you if you'll tell me the height of this building. Finally, well, anyway, that's all his examples. But the whole point is that is what he would not do. He would not do the one thing that the barometer was congruent with, that was congruent with the design of the barometer, right? And to find it funny, we have to take certain delight in the incongruity of those two worlds. Okay, so I'm arguing here for having to do with incongruity perceived, okay, but in a zillion different ways, filtered through all different cultures and times and so on. I'm not going to deal with the misuse of humor here, of humor to do damage, which is, you all know enough about that, but I want to speak about humor that's constructively used. Rightly used, it is a great gift of God. I won't even begin to touch on all the things it's good for. In the light of the ironies that I've spoken of already, it can start to challenge those who see themselves or others in one dimension only, either all glory or all ruin, all greatness or all vileness, leading to arrogance or despair. Humor can lift up our sense of our value and dignity and bring it up from despair to hope. But humor also can be a corrective to inflated pride and arrogance, can pull us down from arrogance to humility. It can show us that we're not all glory and we're not all ruin. In other words, it can move us toward a vitally important self-understanding. The sociologist Peter Berger claimed that totalitarians and fanatics don't have a sense of humor. And I think he almost said can't have a sense of humor. They need to see life in one dimension only, with no incongruity. There's only one truth, there's only one way of doing things, and only one name on the ballot. But anyone who lives under a dictatorship needs to develop a rich humor. Humor being a kind of incongruity helps remind them that there's not just one version of reality. There are two versions at least, and a dissonance between them. This incongruity helps to safeguard sanity and not allow them to be crushed by their own suffering as if the power of the oppressors was the only story. So it helps one believe that justice and dignity exist, even though that I can't see any around me at the moment. I think of some of the, as has been chronicled quite a lot, some of the humor within communist Russia pre-1989. They told different stories of jokes that they would tell each other. They told of a new stamp issued with Stalin's picture on it, but they soon discontinued the stamp because it just wouldn't stick to the envelopes. And they discovered the problem was that people spat on the wrong side of the stamp. Or the definition of a string quartet. A string quartet is the Leningrad Symphony Orchestra after a concert tour in the United States. So, if you can laugh at these, you're less under the heel of the dictator. there's a part of you inside that he doesn't own, and that is not in his power. And you're lifted from a despair to a certain hope that there's a justice someplace in the world, though I can't see it around me now. Laughing at yourself also can blow your arrogance to pieces. Seeing yourself suddenly as ridiculous can help you see the truth. It can destroy proud obstacles to the knowledge of God. Job was not in a laughing mood, but God asked him, "Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion?" I wonder if that wasn't to shake Job loose to laugh at some of the questions. God asked him about 75 questions. He didn't know an answer to a single one of them. But most of them are so utterly outrageous that you wonder whether Job wasn't smiling at the end as he was learning something about his own misguided pretenses of wisdom about how the universe should be run. Jesus' humor had often, I think, an apologetic edge to it. He would often most of his humor is through radical exaggeration unto absurdity. And I suspect many would have smiled as they felt the force of things he said. One of my favorites is in the Sermon on the Mount, totally familiar to you all. "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye while the log is in your eye'? You hypocrite." Then he goes on it. But persuading someone that they're a hypocrite is a tough sell. But if you see any humor in this ridiculous image, it may be easier actually to accept it, to consider that it applies to you. I mean, the idea is here, as some commentators have pointed out, this is a picture of this is worse than the blind leading the blind. This is a picture of a blind oculist. No, this is someone set to do heavy duty damage and do something completely that is completely out of range and is completely unqualified for. But it's so absurd that it could make you laugh, in which case, maybe you or I would be more likely to recognize ourselves in that image, as it applies to us. Then you hear him more in the tone of a severe rebuke in the last week of his life. "You blind guides, you strain out a gnat but swallow a camel." Again, a ridiculous exaggeration. But here I think the force is more of real satire, a satirical thing. Obviously meaning that humor to cut sharply and jar them loose from again, the legalism that we talked about already, from stopping thinking in that way. I thought of giving you one relatively contemporary example from a sermon by the late Reverend Peter Gomes. He was a chaplain for many years at Harvard's Memorial Church. died just a couple of years ago. How he kept his job, I have no idea, because he believed enough of the gospel that no one who believed that much of the gospel has held a job there for probably since the mid-19th century. But maybe you'll see a hint of that. A church filled with Harvard students, professors, and ever so respectable liberal citizens of Cambridge. His text was Matthew 21:31. Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, tax collectors and harlots go into the kingdom of God before you." This was his text to these ever so respectable folks in Cambridge. I'll read you the run up for it. He's dealing with Rahab the harlot. As his example here. The virtuous, respectable, the Christians of America have no need to hear the good news of Christ because we have already achieved a level of perfection consistent with our level of comfort. Who of us thinks of ourselves so wicked and our life so bad that we have an urgent need to repent here and now? No, we cannot. We will not see God's future, for we are so seduced by the conveniences and conventional wisdom of the present. Unlike Rahab, we are unwilling to give up what we have and what we know to risk going with God. Rahab had everything to lose, and she gave up everything to go with God. The trouble with us is that we don't want to lose anything and are unwilling to give up any of it. Let me keep my intellectual superiority, my economic security, my social stability. Let me keep my habits and my ways. Let me keep my timetable and my priorities. And indeed, let me keep even my anxieties and my neuroses. We say to ourselves, then, If God can fit into that, I will pencil him in. That is why the harlots and even the despised IRS drones will get into heaven before you. Now, you see, this has got a real edge to it. I will pencil in a meeting with the creator of the universe. I'll pencil it in because I might have something more important come up in the meantime, so I want to be able to erase it. You know, see, he's got a real edge to this, and to people who need to hear it. And somehow he didn't get fired. He's able to. This again is what humor can do. It can carry a truth that is a very hard hitting one, and yet it isn't so aggressive. It isn't so attacking. It's really asking someone to see yourself in this way without it being a personal attack. Okay, I've tried to show two uses of irony in the Bible: the irony of glory and ruin, and the need to accept, which we need to accept as a true self-understanding for those who trust in the gospel of Christ, but also the intolerable ironies that we should reject, and reject and in turn to the gospel of Christ. Then we've looked at humor and how humor can also interact with this same kind of ironic, these two pictures of ourselves. It can help someone from despair to hope, and also help someone down from arrogance to humility. I will let Pascal finish the lecture for us, a timeless apologist. Jesus Christ is a God whom we approach without pride and before whom we humble ourselves without despair. Okay, I'll stop there and then over to you all. These Friday nights, if you haven't been here before, we have an open discussion that goes on for as long as anyone wants to talk, but if anyone needs to leave, just feel free to take off, and that's just fine. So, anyone want to start us off? Yeah. Yeah, some years ago, quite at least 15 or 20 years ago, who was the guy who did this? Do you remember? Anyone know?
Patch Adams.
Was it?
The movie was called Patch Adams. Robin Williams was in it.
And did he do that?
It was a story.
Yeah, well, I don't know who the story was about. Yeah, there's a famous guy who was very well known in the media, who the doctors had given up on. He had some sort of terminal cancer. And he said, okay, I'm just going to rent, I don't know, 40 or 50 of his favorite comedies. And he showed films to himself day after day.
And laughed and laughed.
And got better. And lived for quite a few years afterwards. And people have written up. I guess they've done that. I've forgotten they've done a film.
No, Patch Adams is a doctor who. This was his approach to.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So it wasn't.
It wasn't that
story.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be great if I'm sure some doctors did do some really interesting study on it, because he came with no medical training at all, and yet said, I've got nothing to lose, I'll do this, and it certainly worked for him. But I'm sure there's been a lot of. I wish I could remember his name, because he's someone who was at that time quite a well-known guy for film or television or something like that. And hard. I didn't get all into all the good things humor can do, which would be endless. Tom.
He was Norman Cousins.
Okay. Thank you. Good.
You're welcome.
Yeah. That's Yeah, that's and I wonder how long he lived, or whether he's still alive even. because that's intriguing. But because I mean, you think of what humor can do to a bunch of people laughing together about the same thing.
Yeah.
It binds people together. You share something, a common sense of the ridiculous, a common sense of which is really, someone has a good sense of humor, which means a sense of humor like yours, is a wonderful thing to come across with the same sense of the ridiculous, the same sense of the absurd or whatever. But it can be so different. You can think of, and just reading this, done work on it, Jewish humor is just so very specific and brilliant, and much of it is self mockery on things that anti-Semitic people joke about with evil intent. They'll joke about the same things because they make them funny. And it's amazing. Different. We were talking with someone about Australian humor the other day, and but there's all sorts of different traditions of what's funny and what isn't. What you can say without, I mean, you have all sorts of lines like what you can say without insulting someone. That's a touchy one. But yes.
Would you like to say more about? You mentioned, I think, near the beginning about Christians being disturbed by irony and humor and so forth. Do you want to say more about where that comes from?
Yeah, I think humor can be seen as as light, frivolous, and beneath us, because we take take ourselves so seriously. They say a woman came to Spurgeon, the great London preacher, and criticized him for having too many jokes, too much humor in his sermons. And he said, "Oh my goodness, you know, if you only knew all the jokes I cut out." So she didn't gain much ground with him, I guess. So I think there's that, and also that humor is used destructively all over the place, and so it can be tarred in people's minds. Its use can be tarred by the destructive use of humor. Irony, particularly after the postmodern sort of era. It's as if they own irony now, or something like that, and it's been used as a negative thing, as a way of saying anything you say in seriousness, you obviously mean in with irony, with an ironic seriousness, with a fake seriousness, and so anyone saying anything with conviction or some sort of sense of seriousness could only be using a fake kind of a seriousness, because, to mock the idea of being serious or sure or certain about anything. So I think Christians can be overly afraid of irony there, that they're being sucked into something postmodern. But that's a very specific kind of irony. It's really more cynicism than irony, because irony is something really very broad and to me, profoundly usable. All over the place, yeah.
I think perhaps there are two other terms that are related to this idea that you're pursuing here. One of them is flippancy,
yeah,
and the other is snark.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was C.S. Lewis who observed that flippancy is the assumption that the joke has been made. And everything you say, therefore, is a joke, and there is nothing to be serious about.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true. Snark, I've always just taken to be cynicism, and just the sort of, well, a very kind of a put down, a personal put down kind of cynicism, seeing through to see the snarkiest thing you can say or write about someone or something that happened, which I wouldn't want to defend. Having written a book against cynicism, I don't want to defend snark. Yeah. Although, I mean, these words need to, you know, we need to know how they're being used by anybody. They can be used in different ways.
I think a lot of people have made money by going on TV with snark.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a commercial product, it seems to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Probably doesn't do everybody a lot of good, though.
No. That was a guy from the writes for the New Yorker wrote a book called Snark, which was, I didn't think it was not, it was just not very enlightening, but it was interesting, but it was, he was somewhat critical of it, but not maybe for the best reasons. But, again, language is so powerful and can do such powerful things to people, whether it's humorous or not, or whether it's scary what we let loose. Yeah, did you?
It seems like the humor that's really productive that you're talking about is about not taking ourselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very uncomfortable with some of the jokes that people make about things that are sacred.
Yeah.
and mm-hmm. I don't know that people always sort of know the distinction
between
a really good use of humor as a really productive thing,
mm-hmm.
a really good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was interviewing teachers a while ago, it's high on our list that they had to have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
You can't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be a hard-working situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the kind, you know, that were the examples and the things you've been talking about.
Yeah.
But to take things that are really sort of secret and make kind of just bad jokes about them.
Yeah.
to kind of make them.
Yeah, and that's... I don't want to be the one to actually draw a line between acceptable and unacceptable use of say religious or theological issues in humor. I think it's very tricky, but I feel it intensely when I think someone is just making cheap jokes I feel that about people so much. People joke about each other and laugh at each other and in ways that I think are oftentimes without any sense of, I think, of what damage can be done, and if someone's being laughed at. Everybody's laughing, so it's okay. Not really, necessarily. Maybe not at all. So I think it's a very... It's an area of tremendous need for sensitivity, I think. Yeah, Ben?
Yeah, just to echo that, I guess I feel like for humor to be in any way redemptive, you have to have some understanding that the person you're speaking to will perceive the incongruity as humorous. But you just think of the many examples of even a very innocently meant joke might hurt someone's feelings. It wasn't meant to cut them down or to take their dignity away or whatever, but that's where I feel like... I don't know, I feel like the self-deprecating humor can sort of be a good place to start in this sense.
Mm-hmm.
it shows that you're not placing yourself above being ridiculous.
Yeah.
Even if we're talking about something that we are taking very seriously, to take ourselves less seriously as we communicate it somehow can be a disarming thing. Otherwise, someone just feels like the joke is on them. And that's, I mean, even very well-intentioned humor can backfire really badly. I mean, it's just hurting people's feelings and getting their back up. If they feel they're being laughed at, that's about the most injuring thing to pride that you can experience.
Yeah, especially in a group. If someone is targeted and laughed at by everybody in a way that humiliates them, that's pretty heavy for or you know, that ranks pretty high on the real violation.
See, what would Jesus you know, use this intense ironic or exaggerated imagery to people to try to point out their hypocrisy or whatever it is, their blindness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know, but my hunch is that the smile might have come later, you know, like might have just been offended, you know, rather than be, maybe this is the way my imagination engages with those stories.
Yeah.
I doubt, I can't see people laughing right away.
Yeah.
But maybe later, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I've had quite a few years
to
that's right. Yes.
But the bystanders might have laughed and said, well, I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
I think what Jesus is calling the Pharisees, you whitewash tombs, and that they probably didn't laugh at that, but some of the
there might have been some others laughing.
Yes. I was just thinking, mostly I've been talking earlier with Winnie about just beginning to read the Everlasting Man book by P.K. Chesterton and talking about the difference between light and dark mythology and the difference that is between light and dark humor and the concept of be light that attends to light humor, that there's a love in it. There's an indulgence in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the intent is not to tear down, but to point out incongruity in a way that shows that you delight in it, that it is amusing, and that it brings you a humility that isn't destructive.
Yeah.
And just thinking about Jesus saying things like, I'm certain when he said to Martha, you know, Martha, Martha, that there was humor in the eyes and the eyes that you are worried about many things.
Yeah.
Because he delighted in her.
Yeah, and that's helpful. And I think what Lenny mentioned as well is that not taking yourself too seriously is got to be seen part of a lot of things. If we're very prickly, very thin-skinned, and prickly, we're going to get in trouble all over the place. And we've got to be able to laugh at ourselves, or as Ben said, self-deprecating humor. It's not that can be almost a a formulaic thing to do. I sometimes think politicians have to have at least one self-deprecating joke before in part of a speech or something like that. So it can be, and that I think it can be formalized, which is not what it's about. But it's the willingness to do that and see oneself as a ridiculous person as well is sort of required, isn't it? If we see ourselves truly, yes.
I was going to say too. I think when you go into a situation, I don't start out with humor. I think you earn the right to be humorous, in the sense of you know the people you're with. And I guess when I think of humor, I think of it sharing humor with others. That's humor for me. I mean, sometimes I laugh at myself, but I usually will laugh about something that the rest of the people that I'm with will laugh. So. And I feel like that's earned. You have to get to know the people you're with to share the joke with them or to share humor with them. And I don't think Jesus really, I may be wrong on this, but I don't think Jesus really opened up any of his sermons and stuff with a joke. I think he presented what he had to say and the jokes were more towards the middle. You know? So I think with humor you have to be there saying, I don't know this audience. And if Jesus Christ knew them, but I'm saying, I as a person, I don't know this audience well. And I'm going to learn who they are, listen to them and talk with them, and then I can share the humor if I feel more comfortable. So I think humor comes as an earned gift, maybe. Not right, but you have to earn it before you can share it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, certainly sometimes it's if you don't, in a sense, have a right in the sense of knowing the people well, you can just really put your feet in it in a way that's destructive. But, you know, yes.
I don't remember where I read this, but an author was dealing with the Pharisees and Sadducees and a lot of the Mishnah, the rules and regulations they come up with. And he was talking about the idea of a Sabbath day's journey. And you can push that legalistically even further, and they could have made a rule, you don't go out of your house on the Sabbath. You know? And his point was they kind of relaxed that a little bit to say, okay, there's a certain distance you can go to accomplish whatever is necessary. You know? So his point was, from their point of view, maybe they were being compassionate and relaxing the letter of the law by allowing a Sabbath day's journey. Mm-hmm. So when Jesus complains to them, to this, and calls them whitewashed tombs, sticking to the letter of the law, I imagine some of them might have been saying, what are you talking about? We're compassionate people. We've seen what God requires in the Word, and we've tried to work with that to allow people a measure of freedom within.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the way we think about the Pharisees.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to know because, I mean, the whole first century Judaism is not one thing, was not one thing. So there was an enormous variety then of, you have the different parties, Pharisees, Sadducees, and all of the groups within them, within those. And then there were zealots, and then there were all sorts of, and just all kinds of different directions. But there certainly was something, I mean, they had, you know, maybe, I'm not sure this was exactly when Jesus was alive, but shortly after, like about 1,000 regulations to do with Sabbath observance itself. And so it was pretty brutal, the way he was treated was pretty rough on just that healing thing. So it's very unlikely that they were all of one attitude. We know that some of them certainly weren't. We're very open to him from the start. So I think we just need to have a wider view of and not put them all in the super legal category. But certainly the ones that he's crossing swords with are pretty tough on things. And as Paul describes his own experience, so there certainly was a very legalistic strand there that really was not only legalistic morally, but was really into works righteousness, was into we really are okay ourselves as we are before God because we've obeyed the law. So he had a lot to challenge. But again, with a whole nation which was in the midst of transition in all sorts of ways, there's all sorts of things going on. Yeah. Yeah.
Two things. I just wanted to say in response to your comment about earning right. I relate to that, but I would really hesitate to sort of say when we could be humorous, because I'm married to a person who uses humor so that he can be serious, earn the right to be serious to people, you know, like who's in the other group. it takes a lot for me to feel comfortable, like, okay, I can let my guard down and be silly, you know, or, so, I don't know, I just think there's such a wonderful variety in our personalities and our defaults that we can make space for.
Yeah.
Dick, my question is, any free advice on how to cultivate humor about yourself and not taking yourself so seriously? I think of even this very morning, by 7:15, things were like disintegrating in my house. There were ants in the pantry. Lily was throwing Cheerios on the floor. I couldn't find food. They didn't have the right kind of food to pack lunches. And I was like, rah! I think I literally did that. And there wasn't a lot of humor in me about the situation. And it actually took sort of like stepping away and being with other people to kind of immediately see the humor in it. So what occurs to me is, like, I don't know how to do that alone. Being with other people and almost like having a little bit of an audience or other people who are like, oh, well, that's not how my morning went. Like, infuse the levity for me, but, you know, like,
we don't always have the luxury to. I mean, I do. I live here, but like, I don't often want to step out of my house and be like, "Well, my morning was a little ridiculous, and I'm ridiculous in my morning," you know. Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But yeah, like how do we cultivate that ability to sort of step back from the moment and be like, "Oh, maybe this is funny. Maybe this could be funny."
Maybe ask us a question. How could this be funny? How could it? Where would I be? What sort of mindset would I need if I was going to see this as funny?
Throwing it at Lily.
It's worth asking, though, when what sort of situations, if there's a common line, where I'm most likely to be overcome by a sense of the seriousness of my situation being awful. And how to sort of think of ways to deal with that. I mean, I think oftentimes it shifts a little bit, but it's when we're criticized, it's hard to be light about not take myself too seriously if I'm criticized. That's after all defenses come up, and to think of how to fire back.
Can that include criticizing yourself?
Yeah.
Can you describe that? That's what I would be doing.
Right. Yeah.
Why didn't I get this figured out beforehand?
Yeah.
I mean, what I was thinking to your comment about having humor under dictatorships, I'm like, well, geez, I need to learn to laugh at myself so that I'm free from the dictatorship of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure there's a even free advice that I can give you that's worth much.
What? Threw away the inside of his printer trying to put a new cartridge in. Bought a new cartridge and handed them what we thought was just the old cartridge, but it was the innards of the printer. And so now we have to get a new printer. And it wasn't funny.
It's not funny in the moment, right? Like, distance takes distance. Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I just have a line that comes through is, this is not the end of the world. This is not a major, life-changing or even history-changing event. This is, and to know, we will laugh about this. It may not take us even very long, but we will laugh. And that's helpful to know. And what you need to do is to somehow relativize that dominating sense of this is an absolute catastrophe, this is a disaster, and it's all my fault, or it's all her fault, or his fault. Yeah, Ben.
Huge part of it is just having friends in similar situations, or friends you can tell the story to.
Yeah.
It might not help you in the moment. I don't think there's much of it. I think it was pretty much helpless in the moment. The technique to suddenly magically be able to laugh at yourself when you're beside yourself with rage about something.
So, could probably find an injection.
But if you're in the habit of sharing these kind of ridiculous stories with friends who are in similar situations and who can laugh and who laugh at their own ridiculous mornings, that I think is worth a lot. That helps you see the absurdity of something quicker, I think.
Yeah.
If you can articulate it and know that it's going to make your friend laugh.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a movie, I don't remember what it is, but the question is asked, do you know what the key to humor is? And the young man says no, and his father says, it's timing.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes back to the merit thing, knowing the timing, and then distancing from the event. Mm-hmm. I just think that's pretty profound. The key to humor is timing.
It's one of the keys.
One of the keys.
Yeah. Because there's a time, there will be a time at which you can laugh at things that you couldn't
right now.
A little earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if someone tries to get you to laugh too soon,
it's not gonna
you're going to get some pushback.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wasn't it
John Gay who said life is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel?
Oh, yeah. Tragic.
True. And then Chesterton said, the wise and understanding man, I believe, carries comedy in his head and tragedy in his heart. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to look at the comedy of something in your head at any moment without becoming a flippant person, but having tragedy in your heart about what is truly tragic. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the printer's not a tragedy, probably, anyway, though at the time it seems that way.
No, it's going to cost money to go buy
a printer. Yeah, which is a tragedy.
That's cost you to find
one. I also need to print up this lecture. Fortunately, I could send it on to Mike. Chesterton, though, is interesting. It's one of the things I cut out of this because I was just trying to. Sure, but he would say things like, I have no idea where he said this, but if you see a man walking across the London Bridge and his hat blows off and he chases his hat across the London Bridge, and if you find that funny, that proves the existence of God.
Yeah, what a great statement. Does anyone want the answer?
He has an answer, which might not satisfy everybody, which is that it's very much what we were talking about tonight, is that the human condition is such that we are made for dominion over the earth, we're out to control, and have everything work out the way we want it to work out, and but nature is forever tripping us up, or reality is tripping us up, making us fall on our face, making our hat blow off, and whatever, always going wrong, we're always being frustrated. So it's in a sense it's the glorious ruin kind of a thing.
It's the incongruity.
Yeah, the incongruity between those two things, and so if you find that funny, you're responding to that incongruity between who we're meant to be, because you wouldn't find it funny if people weren't meant to walk across in a dignified fashion across London Bridge with their hats on, you know, and umbrellas rolled up by their side, if that blows off, that's an intrusion into that world, and so you're then living in a world that's the world that the Bible describes. Yeah, and that proves the existence of God. So, but there's something right about that. Getting back to Sarah's question too, is that, hey, this is the kind of world we live in. This is what it's like. This is. Where none of us have perfect control. We're all always going to have kids do the wrong thing at the wrong time, or we're going to drop something ourselves, or lose our grip, or do something that's absolutely stupid, like what we just did today. If we're primed by this is the nature of the world we're living in, this is who we are. Then it's not the end of the world. It's just things happening as they have happened and probably will continue to happen. And pretty soon we'll be able to laugh at it. Yeah, Marty.
Well, I've heard you often say, and I've experienced it since you've been married a long time and brought up three kids, but that without humor, and particularly without being able to laugh at yourself and help your kids laugh at themselves, you just can't. I think you stay... One of us would end up in prison, someone else would end up dead. You really need humor to raise kids and to defuse situations and not let them escalate, you know, with children and with discipline and kind of thing. He was very good at it, better than I was. I would get more.
But it's so easy to just objectify all the hurt, frustration in this world, and just look at it through our heads and be cynics and not look at it through our hearts. And that's the tricky thing, because I think a lot of men especially build up defenses where everything's fine, you know, and it's a defense against anything hurting.
Yeah, that's another whole deal of how humor can be complete distraction and a way of avoiding. It can be one of those obstacles to the knowledge of God, to taking anything seriously. Yeah. And particularly certain relationships, I find, can get in a groove. And they're hard, it's hard to break out of the groove, because you always sort of get together with this person, joke with this person. It's hard to break free from that, even when there are serious things to talk about.
Chesterton is one obvious example of someone who used humor to tear down strongholds.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of other Christian writers or musicians or artists or even Christian comedians, say, who have done that effectively?
Not very well. I think Lewis does it a certain amount. This guy that I quoted, Peter Gomes, does it quite a lot. Did it quite a lot in his preaching. In ways that I thought was quite effective. I mean, I'm not sure I would.
That wasn't Phil Fisher.
Excuse me?
Phil Fisher.
Don't know.
Larry the tomato, about the tomato and Larry
the cucumber.
Thank you, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking, do you remember Mike Warren?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm familiar with this.
Mike Warnke?
Yeah.
He was a former Satanist who he did a number of albums about his life. For example, how he didn't want to be part of the Marines. He didn't want to be in the Navy, so he decided to join the Marine Corps. And when he joined the Marine Corps, shortly after that point, he became a medic, and he discovered that the Navy didn't have their own medical services, so they used Marines. And his whole life was... Most of these stories were about him pulling a run away from God because you know what God's going to do scenario, and God catching him in it.
Uh-huh.
He had a number of stories about his time in Vietnam. He spent in Vietnam.
Huh.
And they're hilarious. I don't know if they're available even anymore.
Huh. I remember hearing his name, but I don't know much about him. So, yeah, anyone else know anyone who's... It certainly is... I guess there are Christian comedians as... I don't know, I'm a little bit nervous that... But I mean, I shouldn't, having said what I've said tonight, that it should be a legitimate thing to do. But
there is one right now, John Crist... YouTube videos. He is brilliant at highlighting absurdities within Christian culture.
Uh-huh.
It's awesome.
From within it or without?
From within. Yeah, no, absolutely from within. And
who is this now? Sorry.
John Crist.
How do you spell Chris?
C-R-I-S-T. And it hurts because it's true and makes you think, what? Do we do that? That's weird. Or that's wrong.
Yeah.
Seems really counterproductive to what we say we're about.
Yeah.
He's really fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That what is he? Is he? What does he do? Is he a stand up? I see.
Yeah.
Do you do stand up? Wow.
A lot of funny videos.
Yes.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
Some of the type of thing you're talking about is done by non-Christian comedians. I mean, I think something like Louis C.K. does, it's a whole mixed bag. There's horribly crude stuff mixed in with it. But, like, he's very, very perceptive about human nature. And I don't think he doesn't have much of the glory, actually, come think of it. But maybe it could be a valuable deflating I don't know. I probably shouldn't have just recommended Lucy
Case.
Yes, go ahead. I was just rereading the article.
And I was just thinking tonight about how in that article that it notes that lots of comedians will no longer do colleges because nobody can take a joke.
Then like,
and just the degree of
sensitivity.
There's such a
that's interesting.
And so so comedians are like, it's not worth it. Can't do it. Like the whole premise of stand up comedy is like being able to laugh at yourself, being able to poke fun at people, being able to make a joke. And, that's not, you just can't do that.
There
was, I forgot what she was, Irma Bombeck.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's
hilarious.
Hilarious, and a Catholic Christian of some kind. And I remember her, somebody asking her, she asked about when you pray.
When you pray, do you joke with God? And it's just, no, that's God's turn to laugh. When I pray.
But she also makes hilarious fun of the humorless, the feminists who were humorless at the time in the 70s. Just, again, it reminds me of whatever that quote was you said, that fanatics and totalitarians and fanatics don't make humor because the only one truth. And she's very good on very funny humorless.
Yeah, Richard.
You mind if I tell a joke?
How many feminists does
it take to change a light bulb? How many feminists does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is one, and that's not funny.
Okay.
There is a problem, I think, with Christians in general being in entertainment roles.
Yeah.
In that they're sort of looked down on, I think, by church culture. And so if you had a guy going to Sunday school, he says, I want to grow up and be a famous TV comedian. The Sunday school teachers say, no, Johnny, why don't you find a real job?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Sunday school teachers are always very sincere about that sort of thing. I've had several Sunday school teachers myself. And so it's never something that's thought of as being a worthy thing to become.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, that's a sad commentary on Christians, that we have allowed non-Christians to take over the entertainment culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even going back to the 1920s,
mm-hmm.
Strong Christians would say, no, don't make movies. Movies are a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
They can't be used for good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, Billy Graham saw better than that, and he began using movies in the 1950s. But still, we have some lingering, sensibilities like that.
He got into radio really early, and did he?
Yeah.
A huge amount of his growth of his work was through radio.
Yeah, sure. That's a little bit of a tangent on...
Yeah.
Media use in general, but comedy as a profession is sort of an entertainment job.
Yeah.
And it's, looked down upon, I think.
Yeah. No, I think it can be. Yeah, it's true. And I guess it's, things get associated with where you first hear about them or where you first experience them. And some of that can be pretty, you look at the history of theater. And theater was absolutely the bottom spiritually and morally. The Christian should never, ever go to theater. And that was just absolutely self-evident.
You're saying in what time period?
Well, I think...
From Shakespearean days or...
More since then.
In college. The early 60s. We weren't allowed to go to read the plaid chat movies on it. Really? Yeah.
So movie theaters, but like a play would be okay?
We didn't have they were just had a fledgling drama department. They
just
wow.
was kind of really
impressed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because it's. I'm thinking of. I don't know what I mean. Obviously, it's come up to. I wouldn't have known it was coming as recently as that, but I've certainly seen most of the 20th century, a lot of the evangelical church, or maybe the 19th century as well, I would have thought. But because there's so much, I mean, again, when you don't have Christians actually engaged in doing it and writing drama, what is there available? It's written by people who aren't Christians and maybe who are sniping it at much of what we believe. Yeah. But it's somehow come very lately to it. Now we're trying to play catch up, which is better late than not, I think. But yet it's a slow process. Yeah, Maureen?
I was just going to say, the woman at the back who said she doesn't like the, she's not here now, but said about the timing, like a pastor shouldn't tell the joke in the beginning. I don't know if this is what she was talking about, but there's a kind of preacher joking as sort of comic relief from something serious is going to say, and beginning things with some jokes that are just kind of, which really bugs me. But humor, our pastor uses humor really well in his sermons, and they're very much about helping the congregation laugh at themselves. And see, and he'll start to say, "Can I tell it? We go to a black church." And he's very expressive, but he uses humor really well. And I've always thought, I remember thinking this about Edmund Clowney, who was the president of the seminary that he went to, used humor really well in his preaching, and it drives the truth home rather than being a distraction from the truth or a comic relief from the truth or something. That's a distinction that I always felt. It somehow the examples of the humorous examples would just make you feel the truth more strongly of what he was trying to say, and that's how our pastor uses it, really, very wisely.
Yeah, I have difficulty as well with someone who's you've got to start out with some jokes to make so everyone knows I'm cool.
Yeah,
and I'm one of the boys, and I just that's a hard pill. But there's so much room and to use the power of humor, I think, in what we do, in trying to say the most serious things. Yeah, any other things we want to raise or add or subtract? Well, you're all very patient.
Great.
Thank
you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I lived and worried about this for 2 hours. I was going to get stepped on it. Oh, okay. Knock something down.
I was thinking there'd be enough wires here that people would be intimidated somehow.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. Yeah.
Yes, we are staying here.
Just for
it's
one
very
night.
Nice, yeah, for one night.
Okay. Oh, that's great. Yes.
Good. Yeah. That was good.
Lots of them are good.
It was a base.
I'm here. I'm looking for around for something.
Sometimes
I thought I saw a box here last week, and I thought it had 2401 or 2 letters on it. It had. It was like this, but it had the 2401 and two numbers. I was just wondering if it's there.
Does that mean something to you, or?
Yeah, in a way that doesn't mean anything to other people.
Really?
Yeah. It's you don't know what 2401 is. See?
I certainly don't.
It's 7 cubed.
7 cubed.
I mean, so 7 to the 4th power.
Right.
I missed that much because it has no deep meaning, but there's no translator until the translator shows up. So it's 7 to the 4th power.
I may have heard of the Japanese novelist Shusaku Endo. He's most famous for Silence.
Right.
He also wrote a novel called Wonderful Fool, which is a more comic novel. And the main character is a kind of, in the tradition of a holy fool, which is kind of a Catholic slash Orthodox tradition. And it's quite clear when he shows up that he is quite incongruous as a Christian in the world of emerging modern Japan. And he's there as a missionary and basically appears very inept and yet accomplishes something for God. And so it's kind of Indu's probably funniest novel.
Ah.
And you might enjoy seeing that as one attempt to use the humor to...
What's the novel called?
It's called Wonderful Fool.
Wonderful Fool.
I'm going to go over to that.
Reality,
yeah, because that's...
I thought we were so close to the airport interview.
Indeed, for good Christian literature.
I've
not read much by him.
Right after that.
I know. We have to go to the airport. It's like they're 2 hours to Charlotte or 2 hours to Atlanta. Charlotte is always better than Atlanta, so they don't try to do that.
Really?
My family's in California.
You do remind me of myself.
You just keep going.
I can't even read
it. It always makes me
feel so great. Maybe I can just pull the plug.
So it takes 2 hours to get to the airport. You have to go to the airport.
So should we be brave and do that?
Hold
our breath.
Just drive.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Good to see you. Are you